time we were together, we actually looked at the idea of what it meant to be made in the image of God. And we really went into detail on what it meant to be an imager of God. So if you didn't hear that study, you can actually view it on our website, www.beacon-ministries.org, under the quarantine archives. It'll be listed under. And I'd really suggest maybe listening to that study, what it meant to be an imager. And last week during our Zoom conference, Phil, in his second message, did something that went really nicely with a lot of the things that we were talking about. So if you have time during the week, I would suggest listening to those two studies. Both of them are available on that website. Today I want to pick up with the idea of Eden. And what is the importance of Eden in all of the things that we've looked at so far, and in particular, the counsel of God. And hopefully by the end of the study, we'll have a good grasp of Eden's significance and how it actually affects the counsel of God. So I'm going to ask if you could to turn to Genesis chapter 2 and verse 8. Genesis chapter 2 and verse 8. Reading out of the concordant. Yahweh Elohim planted a garden in Eden in the east, and there he put the human whom he had formed. Now it's interesting, and we looked at a little bit last week. Phil really went into some detail on it in his second conference message on the Zoom conference. But the idea on how Eden is God's home on earth, it's his residence. It's where the king lives and where his council would meet. Now, I do want to read a short excerpt out of a book. It's called A Temple-Centered Biblical Theology, written by a man by the name of Michael Morales. And just kind of bear with me, because this is really important piece of information that he's going to share, and we're going to dovetail off of what he has to say. It's called A Temple-Centered Biblical Theology. It's written by a man by the name of Michael Morales. Okay? And he writes this. Ugarit, a city-state in ancient Syria, just to the north of Israel, is particularly relevant to any study of God's counsel. The site of Ugarit was discovered in 1928 and excavated in the decades that followed. One of the major finds was a library containing thousands of clay tablets, roughly 1,400 of which were in an alphabetical language now called Ugaritic, that was closer to Biblical Hebrew than any other ancient language. The vocabulary and grammar are in many instances virtually identical. Scholars have learned a lot from this library, both about Ugarit and the content of the Old Testament. The chief deity of Ugarit was El, A-E-L, one of the names that appear in the Old Testament for the God of Israel. El had a divine council whose members were the sons of El, and he had a co-ruler named Baal. Since El's and Baal's duties sometimes appear to overlap, and since Ugarit was so geographically close to Israel, it was small wonder that Baal worship was such a problem in Israel. The discoveries at Ugarit put all of that Old Testament history in context. El and Baal were, to say the least, markedly different in behavior from Yahweh of Israel. But the literature of Ugarit proved very illuminating in other respects, especially as to where El, Baal, and the Ugarit Divine Council lived and held court. At Ugarit, the Divine Council had three levels. The highest authority, El, who did most of his ruling through a co-ruling vizier, Baal, the sons of El, and the messenger gods, or the Malachim. The Council of El met on a mountain or lush garden. These were not different places. Rather, the same place was described in two different ways. The abode of El had an abundant water supply, as it was situated at the source of the two rivers, in the midst of the fountains of the deep, double deep. The Divine Council met in a place called Sapanu, the remote heights of the north. Sapanu meaning north. Council meetings were held in the tents of El, or El's tent shrine, whence divine decrees were issued. At times, Baal's palace was in view with its paved bricks. This is important information because we will see much of it replicated in Israel's scriptures. And the reason this is important is, as we're going to see, the Hebrew Bible uses these same descriptions for the abode and throne room of Yahweh. Where Yahweh is, he is surrounded by his heavenly council and his heavenly assembly, ready to conduct his business. Now, if you turn with me to Isaiah chapter 6, for instance, Isaiah chapter 6, you're going to see this. Isaiah 6, this is probably one of the most famous chapters in the book of Isaiah. It's the one that mentions the seraphim. But Isaiah 6, verse 1. In the year of King Uzziah's death, I saw Yahweh sitting on a throne, high and lifted up, and his skirts were filling the temple. Seraphim were standing above him with six wings to each one, with two each covered his face, and with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew, and this one called to that one and said, "Holy, holy, holy, Yahweh of hosts, the fullness of the whole earth manifests his glory." And it goes down. Isaiah, in this chapter, describes the throne room of God, as Isaiah was privy and had the opportunity to actually see the inner workings of this throne room. And it's a really interesting picture when you read in Isaiah chapter 6 and see this idea of how God's throne room was working and operating. So we see where God's throne is, his council is there, and his assembly is there. We could see the same thing in 1 Kings chapter 22, if you want to turn there. 1 Kings chapter 22. And in 1 Kings chapter 22, a lot of us are probably familiar with this passage, and it is a little bit of reading. I may not read all of it, but on your own, you could read verses 13 going down through 28. I'm just going to read a few verses here. But start at verse 16. Now the king said to him, "How many times have I been adjuring you that you should speak to me nothing but the truth in the name of Yahweh? Then he replied, I saw all Israel scattered over the mountains like a flock of sheep that have no shepherd. And Yahweh said, these have no Lord. Let each man return to his home in peace. At this, the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, did I not tell you that no time he prophesied good for me, but rather evil? Now, we have to understand, there's this, Ahab wants a prophecy to give him good, and he wants it to say what he wants it to say. And the problem is, he doesn't like what the prophets are telling him. Now, coming down, we're going to get a little bit of an insight into God's counsel here. And look at verse 20. Yahweh said, I want you to understand, where was it that we read about them? Well, they were in the mountains. He says, Yahweh said, who shall entice Ahab so that he may march up and fall at Ramoth-Gilead? Now this one said thus, and another was saying thus. Then a spirit came forth, stood before Yahweh, and said, I myself shall entice him. Yahweh asked him, by what means? He replied, I shall go forth, and I will become a false spirit in the mouth of all his prophets. Then he said, you shall entice, and moreover, you shall prevail. Go forth and do so. Now, I want to stop here. It's interesting because we have a little bit of an inkling on how this throne room is working. God asks, Yahweh asks for somebody, one of his divine council members, to do something. And he has a couple of them volunteer to do it. And then one stands up and says, I'll do it, and this is how I will do it. And what's interesting is Yahweh does not tell him how to carry out his wishes. He leaves that up to his council member. The council member, in this case, a spirit who's going to put lies into the mouth of Ahab's prophet, has said, I'm going to do that. Now, it's not that God is advocating lying. He's not. He's not the one lying. It's that spirit who has made this determination, and God has allowed him to exercise that. The whole point of this passage, though, where God is, his counsel is. They're there meeting and operating and conversing with one another and making policy together. The Old Testament really has a three-tiered council structure, much like that the Ugarit lays out. You have Yahweh at the top. He has a co-regent who's also named Yahweh, by the way, as we'll see in an upcoming study in a few weeks. Then you have the sons of God who constitute his council in the second tier. And then you have what we typically call angels, or in the Hebrew, the malachim, or messengers. This lying spirit here in 1 Kings is one of those angelic beings. You have that tiered structure, and it's laid out for us all through the Old Testament. But not only do we see that, but we see that a tent structure, just like in the Ugarit as well, plays a very crucial role in the idea of God's counsel. If you turn back with me to Exodus for a second, Exodus chapter 29, 29 verse 42. It says here, a regular ascent offering throughout your generations at the opening of the tent of appointment before Yahweh, where it shall keep appointment with you to speak to you there. And they will keep appointment there with the sons of Israel, and it will be hallowed by my glory. I want to stop for a second. Last time we were together, we saw that being made in the image of God meant that we were made where we could represent God. Adam was made and created to be a member of God's divine council. God has a divine council in the heavens, and with the creation of humanity on the earth, in the formation of Eden, we see that God has a human divine council on the earth. A heavenly divine council, an earthly divine council. The heavenly divine council is where God is, and the earthly divine council is where God is. In this passage here in Exodus, it's the idea of the tabernacle. And with the idea of the tabernacle, there was a place of meeting. The concordant renders it that he would keep appointments with them. Other translations will render it meeting. I shall keep my meeting with you is the way a lot of other translations render it. The thing is that God would speak with them there. And it says in verse 43 that God is hallowing that tabernacle structure by his very presence. His glory would fill it. And you actually see that at the end of chapter 40, where the glory of God fills the tabernacle. Go with me to Exodus chapter 33. Exodus chapter 33. And verse number 9. It came to be, as Moses entered the tent, that the cloud column descended and stood at the opening of the tent. And he spoke with Moses. When all the people saw the cloud column standing at the opening of the tent, all the people rose and bowed themselves down, each man at the opening of his tent. So Yahweh spoke to Moses face to face, just as a man speaks to his associate. When he returned to the camp, then his minister, Joshua the son of Nun, a youth, did not remove himself from the midst of the tent. The whole idea here in Exodus is that God is meeting face to face. In this passage here in chapter 33, he's meeting face to face with Moses. Why? Because Moses is a member of God's divine human council. Moses is the human representative of the earth in the divine council of God. And later on, we're going to see that Israel is intended to be included in this divine counsel. The tabernacle tent structure, sometimes called the tent of meeting, is mentioned throughout the books of Exodus through Judges. And they are clear places where God dwells and hands down his decrees to his council. And his council hands those decrees down to others. Yahweh could also be found on mountains. Typically, Sinai or Zion. In Psalm 48, if you want to turn there, Psalm chapter 48, look at verse 1. Great is Yahweh, and praised exceedingly. In the city of our Elohim, his holy mountain, lovely of undulation, the elation or the height of the entire earth is Mount Zion, the flanks or sides of the north, the town of the great king. Now, it's interesting. Here is a reference to Jerusalem. It's said to be the city of God, and it is located in the sides of the north. That's an interesting passage here. It is located in the sides of the north. Interestingly enough, the word Tsafon is the Hebrew word, T-S-A-P-H-O-N. That is the exact same word used in the Ugarit. Mount Zion is the Mount of Assembly, or the Mount of Congregation, located in the sides of the north that Isaiah references. Go with me to Isaiah chapter 14. Isaiah 14. And in Isaiah 14, let's go to verse 13. Yet you said in your heart, to the heavens shall I ascend. Above the stars of El shall I exalt my throne, and I shall sit on the mount of appointment or congregation, on the remote parts of the north, or again, most translations will have in the sides of the north. I shall ascend unto the high places of the thick clouds. I shall be like the Supreme, or the Most High, or Elyon. The idea here is that if you take it in context, this is a reference to the city of God, Jerusalem, in the context. Now, yes, there's things in layers here. You have the superficial meeting, and then underneath it, you have a whole lot of things going on in the background with it. But notice here, you have the reference to the stars of Al. You have the sides of the north. You have a reference to being Elyon, the one who's supreme in the council of God himself. All of this is describing the idea of where God's counsel is. Where is it? It's in the sides of the north. Where is the sides of the north? Zion. And in particular, Jerusalem. Now, I also made reference to Sinai. And we're going to see that Sinai is also referenced in this way. Go with me to Exodus chapter 24. Exodus chapter number 24. Let's look at verses 9 and 10. Exodus 24, verse 9. According to all that I am showing you, the model of the tabernacle and the model of all its furnishings, thus shall you make it. They will make a coffer of acacia boards, 2 cubits and a half its length, and 1.5 cubits its width, and 1.5 cubits its rise. You will overlay it with pure gold inside, and outside shall you overlay it, and so on. And he continues. Now, the interesting thing in this passage, where is Moses as he's receiving this instruction?
Oh, are we in the right spot? You said 24, 9, and 10.
Oh, I read 25. I'm sorry. Let me go to 24. Sorry about that. Verse 9 of chapter 24. Then Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and the 70 of the elders of Israel ascended. I'm going to stop here for a second. That number 70, keep that in your head. It's going to be significant later on for us. Not tonight, but it will be significant later on as we advance in the study. And they saw the Elohim of Israel, and beneath his feet, as it were, a work of sapphire tiling, as the very heavens for purity. Now, where are they as they ascended here? What mountain did they ascend?
Mount Sinai.
Mount Sinai. So here we have a reference to the God of Israel, the Elohim of Israel, seated, right? And under his feet, as it were, a work of sapphire tiling as the very heavens for purity. The idea here that's being implied is a throne. Moses, the chief priest Aaron, and then 72 others, ascend up, and they see this. They are privy to seeing God. Now notice verse 12. Yahweh said to Moses, ascend to me to the mountain and be there, and I shall give to you the stone tablets, the law, and the instructions which I wrote to direct them. So Moses and Joshua, his minister, rose, and Moses ascended to to the mountain of the one Elohim. I want to stop here. It's in Mount Sinai where God's human council comes to meet with him. It's on Mount Sinai where God gives the decrees to these leaders of Israel, his human council. And then eventually he meets with the head of his human council. So it's interesting. You have Jerusalem, it's called the City of God, and it's also located in the sides of the north. You have Sinai, which is also a place of divine council. And it's interesting, when we think of the divine council, we have to understand that these leaders, these kings, would have multiple abodes. And from these multiple abodes, they could give out decrees and so on and meet with their council. So you're going to have different places oftentimes referenced because, again, the king is mobile. He doesn't have to stay stationary. And you see the same thing even in David's day, with David, for instance. So you have all this information. The Garden of Eden itself, where we began, is a land that is lush and well-watered, just like the Ugarit said the council area of God would be. If you go back to Genesis chapter 2 and verse 5, Genesis 2 and verse 5, and I want to read down a little bit. As for any shrub of the field, it had not yet come into being on earth, nor had any herbage of the field yet been sprouting. For Yahweh Elohim had not made it rain on the earth, and there was no human to serve the ground. But mist, it ascended from the earth and irrigated the whole surface of the ground. Yahweh Elohim formed the human out of soil from the ground, and he blew into his nostrils the breath of life, and the human became a living soul. Yahweh Elohim planted a garden in the east, and there he put the human whom he had formed. I want to stop. It's interesting, Eden is a place where God had placed the man or the human. But what's even more significant is that God himself plants a garden in Eden. It's God who plants the garden. And then, interestingly enough, this garden becomes known as the Garden of God. There's only one other garden in Scripture that is referenced as the Garden of God. That's Gethsemane. Kind of an interesting thing. Both those places are referred to as the Garden of God. Verse 9. So Yahweh Elohim made sprout from the ground every tree desirable to the sight and good for food, with the tree of life in the midst of the garden, and also the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. A stream was flowing forth from Eden to irrigate the garden. From there it parted and became four head streams. The name of the first one is Pishon. It is the one surrounding the whole land of Havilah, where the gold is. The gold of that land is very good. The pearl is there and the onyx stone. The name of the second stream is Gihon. It is the one surrounding stream is Hideko. It is the one going east of Asher, and the fourth stream, it is the Euphrates. It's interesting here that this garden is lush and well watered and is inhabited by the being that God intended to be his counsel on the earth. But this brings up an interesting point. The Garden of Eden. The Garden of Eden is significant because of the words that the prophet Ezekiel gives about it. If you go to Ezekiel chapter 28, we're going to see reference to the Garden of Eden. And in Ezekiel 28, verse 13, you were in the luxury of the Garden of Elohim. Of every precious stone was your booth-like pavilion, carnelian, peridot, and diamond, topaz, onyx, and jasper, sapphire, carbuncle, and emerald. And with gold have you filled your flanks or sides, and your alcoves which are in you. In the day of your creation, they established the anointed cherubs, booth or covering. It's interesting. You were in the luxury of the Garden of Elohim. Now, that's the Masoretic text will have Eden there. Okay. The garden of Elohim is actually coming out of the Septuagint, that rendering. And I'm going to submit, I think the Septuagint actually is much more accurate in Ezekiel 28 than the Masoretic. It's a shame that they kind of, that the concordant here goes back and forth between the Septuagint and the Masoretic rather than just staying with one of them. But the whole idea here, whether you take it as Eden or the Garden of Elohim, the point is the garden is in Eden. Is it not? And this is where God is. Look back here. The Garden of Eden is the Garden of God. That's the point. When you read verse 14, it's referred to as a mountain. Let's read verse 14. The anointed cherub's booth or covering, and I bestowed you in the holy mountain of Elohim, you were in the midst of the fiery stones. Notice here, I bestowed you. Where? In the holy mountain of Elohim. Some translations will say, I created you, right? Or something to that effect. And he's in the mountain. Eden of God. Eden, in this passage then, is being referred to as the mountain of God. That's interesting. The Garden of God is God's holy mountain. Eden is God's holy mountain. Jerusalem is in the sides of the north and is referred to as God's holy mountain. Sinai is referred to as God's holy mountain. The reason for this is these are terms that are used to depict where the council meets. These are places where the council meets to carry out the divine decrees of the sovereign of all creation. Mount Zion is oftentimes described in Edenic terms. For instance, let's go to Isaiah 33, 47. Well, we're in Ezekiel. Let's go to Ezekiel 47. Ezekiel 47. And verses 1 and 2. He brought me back to the portal of the house, and behold, there was water coming forth from under the sill of the house eastward, for the facade of the house faced east. The water descended from underneath along the right shoulder of the house, south of the altar. Then he brought me forth by way of the north gateway and led me around to the outside of the outside gateway that faced the direction of the east. And behold, water was spouting from the right shoulder. In other words, what's he describing? He's describing by where God's temple is, a lot of water. It's a watery habitation. Go with me to Zechariah 14. Zechariah 14. And Zechariah 14, verse 8. And it will come to be in that day that living water shall flow forth from Jerusalem, half of them to the eastern sea, and half of them to the western sea. In summer and in winter shall it continue. The idea here is that waters would flow from Jerusalem. It's a watery area. Jerusalem is being referenced in ways that take you back to Eden. Let's go now to Isaiah 33. Isaiah 33. And verse 20. Going down through verse 22. Perceive Zion, tell. town or city of our appointments. Your eyes shall see Jerusalem as a tranquil homestead, a tent one shall no more pack up, its pegs one shall never uproot again permanently, and all its rope lines shall be pulled away no more. But rather there, Yahweh will be for us in nobility, a place of streams, waterways, broad and expanse, on which no galley fleet shall ever go, and no noble boats shall ever cross them. For Yahweh is our judge. Yahweh is our statute maker. Yahweh is our king. He himself shall save us. Zion is being referenced with Jerusalem in Edenic terms. It's an interesting thing when you read that. We could then say, based off of all of these verses, that the Mount of God is in effect God's temple. If you can locate the mountain of God, you have located God's temple. There are implications to all of this. The Elohim of Israel created Eden not just to be his domain, but because he desires to live among his people. Yahweh desires a kingdom, and he desires rule on this new earth that he had created, and that he will rule, sharing it with humanity and sharing that rule with humanity. That was his original intent. Since the heavenly council is where Yahweh is, then we can expect where Yahweh is on the earth would be the place his earthly council would be. And both councils should function together as a complement to one another. Eden itself is described in Ezekiel 28:2 as the seat of the gods. And it should be plural, not seat of God, but seat of the gods, plural. Let me just read that. Ezekiel 28:2. And it says here, Son of humanity, say to the governor of Tyre, Thus saith my Lord Yahweh, Because your heart is haughty, and you are saying, I am an El, I sit on the seat of the Elohim in the heart of the seas. Yet you are human and not an El, though you are deeming your heart like the heart of the Elohim. The idea here is, and I think the Concordant captures it really well, I sit on the seat of the Elohim, although you wouldn't have to have the there, it's not part of the text. I sit on the seat of Elohim. But it's intended to be understood as plural because you have the singular earlier in the passage, and you have the reference down further on to the plurality where deeming your heart like the heart of Elohim. Most translations don't get this because they're so not looking at the supernatural. They're looking at it from a totally different perspective. But really, you could say it this way in English. Thus says my Lord Yahweh, because your heart is haughty, and you are saying, I am God, I sit on the seat of the gods in the heart of the seas, yet you are human and not a god, though you are deeming your heart like the heart of the gods. And that would be a consistent rendering in English. Unfortunately, most translations really don't render it anything like that. The whole point is the seat of the Elohim, the seat of the divine council. To sit as El means that he is ruling the divine council. That's the point in Ezekiel 28:2. Eden is that seat. The rest of the passage here in Ezekiel 28 goes on to describe where that seat is. And verse 13 culminates it with the Garden of Eden, or Eden. Eden, then, becomes a very significant place in God's plan. Eden was intended to be God's habitation. Eden was intended to be where his human council would meet with him. And thus, if you want to phrase it that way, the seat of all authority on the planet. That was Eden. There's no place like it. Later on, Zion and Sinai become Eden, in, as far as God is concerned. Jerusalem itself, sitting in the sides of the north, where God's house is, where his council meets, carrying out his decrees on planet Earth. Any questions on that? I know that's maybe you've never looked at Eden in that way, so it might be something you've never really thought of or considered or contemplated. Does it make sense?
Yeah, well, I've always thought of Jerusalem as being the original place where Eden was, and the temple that they had put there, very similar to the throne of God being established there when Adam was created.
I think there's a lot of merit to that, because if Gethsemane is the Garden of God, and that's to the east of the city of, in the eastern section of the city, and we know that the Garden of Eden is east within Eden, it would give a lot of credibility that where the Garden of Eden is could be Gethsemane.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Plus, everything that's being said about it would back that idea up. Lot there. And I didn't want to spend I could have probably have ran about 40 more verses tonight, but I think what we had is sufficient to make the point.
Well, to make that point now, and I don't want to get ahead of the study,
did not be, I think it was, one of the cities in the letters to the churches of Revelation is mentioned that the seat of Satan is there. So that would probably be where his council seat was moved to.
When we get to the New Testament, I really want to look at that. I know the exact place you're looking at, and I do actually intend on talking on that.
Okay.
But, yeah, I think there's a lot there when it comes into that. The book of Revelation is really critical on how all this plays out in the end.
Mm-hmm.
But really, for me to really talk on some of the things that are there, I think I need to at least have some of the background support to make sense laid out.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense to me.
Okay. Good.
Hey, Bill?
Yes?
Back in Genesis 2.
Okay.
Makes sense of verses 4 and 5.
Makes sense of verses
4 and 5.
Okay.
Especially 5. The plan isn't making any sense here, but every plant of the field before it was only earth, and every bird of the field before it grew. Okay. For the Lord God had not caused it to rain upon the earth.
Right.
It was not broken down. The sentence doesn't make any sense.
Right.
Me. What am I missing?
Well, again, I think in verse 4, he's given you the chronological record of the heavens and the earth, right? He's
Right.
telling you in verse 5 the condition is for any shrub of the field that had not yet come into being on earth, nor had any herbage of the field yet been sprouting, for Yahweh had not made it rain on the earth, and there was no human to serve the ground. So he's telling you the condition as he was creating it. It wasn't in existence yet as he's creating. He has to create it. In verse 6, he has a mist that comes up so it can irrigate the surface of the ground so that when he does plant those or create those herbs and vegetation, that they can grow and thrive. But he's describing the condition before they're created.
It seems that the mist is adequate to because, well, he's going to plant the garden in a little while.
Right.
But he had said earlier, that must have been some vegetation around. But if it's, not so much of the stuff down, I'm just wondering why would it be phrased that way?
Right. Right. See, I think it's funny because there's such a big debate on where chapter 2 fits in to chapter 1. I mean, there's so many theories on that. The way I always have understood it, though, is that it's just a chronological record where he's filling in some gaps and giving you information. Chapter 1 gives you the chronology. He comes back into chapter 2 and fills in some gaps that maybe he hadn't quite addressed. You know, for instance, how was the human made? Well, he gives us some details to that. He gives us some detail that there had to be some form of irrigation before he could actually create the vegetation for the planet and so on. And I think he's also telling us some important information there on what one of the main tasks of the human, one of his main tasks is to serve that ground, to serve that soil.
The oldest occupation.
It is.
Something that keeps you in the earth.
It is. It's a noble occupation. And one you can relate to.
Indeed.
But there's a lot there.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone want to add anything, or does it make sense? Okay. Because after next week we'll still go a little bit slower, but after next week, we're going to get into some really, maybe some people would say controversial things, and I'm going to lay the proposition out, and you can think about it. I'm going to submit to you the only way the idea of God's divine counsel makes any sense is if his beings that he creates have free will. And I'm going to really talk in some detail why his divine counsel and his human counsel have to have free will. If they don't have free will, then none of it makes any sense. And when I say none of it makes any sense, I mean the entire Bible makes no sense. To me, free will is a foundation, like when you're teaching somebody how to add, they have to understand what the number one is. It's, you know, that's a foundation, right? You have to understand what one of something is before you can understand more of something. Well, free will is at the heart of everything God does. I think the scriptures leave no doubt to that. And the idea of the counsel of God, as we're going to see, dictates that it has to have free will. Otherwise, there can be no rebellion. So, but that's a couple weeks away.
Well, I think it's interesting that you look at the whole of Scripture, and mostly people do not read that into the words. I don't mean that they don't read it into it. They're not looking for it from that aspect. Their mindset is looking at it more from God dealing with human beings in a different way.
Right.
And not in a governmental or a council form.
Right.
In a courtroom or a counseling type of forum.
Right.
It's almost they have this viewpoint that God created everything and it got messed up and then he just let his hands off of it. And that's the way it was, except for a few people or individuals throughout history.
Right.
But when you bring these out, it is new understanding, new material. So, but it's definitely, I think, clearly there.
I think so. I think it's just, the problem is most of these passages we're so familiar with, and we're so familiar with the way that they're typically taught, that sometimes it's hard for us to get our head around something that's a little bit different. But that's okay. Well, having said that, could you close us in prayer, John?
Sure. Thanks. I want to thank you for supplying for not only us, but all of your creation, your word written form. And
everything you've done for us, but we know that it takes your spirit, and that's only given to us on our understanding of what Christ has done for us, and that you have supplied that offering for us to have that reconciliation. We thank you for all of that, Father. We know that you're certainly tremendous in all of your thoughts and ways, and all that we could ever even think or reason. So we ask you to continue to open up our minds to your word, to the things that you're showing us, the things that you're constantly trying to show us, and help us to grow and move to a fuller, more perfect and completed state of maturity as you would have us to be. Sometimes that process takes a little stretching of our minds and our ideas and the information that we've had. So we thank you for Bill, for all the things that he does and studying these out for us, because we do need someone like that